I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Mitch Albom, author of Tuesdays with Maury and the new best-selling book, The First Phone Call from Heaven. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the website at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been traveling a bit the last couple of weeks, first attending a rabbinic conference and then going to Los Angeles to present an award. As always, when I spend time visiting and talking with other rabbis, studying with them, teaching them, and sharing ideas, I find that I'm both inspired and challenged in a variety of ways. Perhaps the best moment for me came when a friend, Rabbi Greg Marks of Philadelphia, led a service on the week of Tu B'Shvat, the Jewish New Year for trees, and incorporated a section on inspirational trees and what they can teach us about spirituality. Originally on the Aish website, this piece on inspirational trees highlighted the giant sequoia, largest living thing on earth, and its reach up towards the heavens, a reminder of our need to reach above ourselves towards God. Next was the quaking aspen grove, in which 100 acres of these lovely trees share an underground root system, making them an integrated whole, demonstrating the interconnectedness of all living things in God's universe. There was a single Purangi cashew tree that roots wherever it spreads, and one tree ends up covering 2 entire acres by flexibly growing, showing that we can extend and grow in very different ways than we expect. And my personal favorite, the Tree of Life in Bahrain in Arabia, which thrives hundreds of miles from any other living plant. It survives its harsh environment by spreading roots down hundreds of feet to water aquifers. It's believed to be over 400 years old, this Tree of Life, and it is one of the loneliest trees in the world. This deep desert tree has a unique quality of being anti-fragile. Anti-fragile is an expression coined by best-selling author Nassim Nicholas Taleb in his book Anti-Fragile: Things That Gain from Disorder. Most of us would say that the opposite of fragile is something strong or unbreakable. But that's just the absence of fragility. The true opposite of fragile is anti-fragile, something that thrives because of stress. The lonely tree in the desert grew strong and survived because it was forced to develop a deep enough root system to reach water hundreds of feet below the ground. The seeds of all trees are inherently anti-fragile. They grow only by breaking apart their hard outer shells. We can make the mistake of believing that we are fragile, since our bodies are so vulnerable to the outside world. But our physical bodies only grow stronger when they are stressed a certain amount. Short, high-intensity workouts, for example, accomplish more than longer, moderate workouts. Our muscles need to be pushed to really grow. As this particular teaching went, the same thing is true in developing our spiritual muscles. Our souls want to reach the heights like the giant sequoia, connect to others in harmony like the aspen grove, and grow wild like a Purangi cashew tree everywhere. But first, our souls need to be challenged, stretched. Like the Tree of Life in Bahrain, our souls are anti-fragile. They grow stronger when pushed to break through their shell, to go outside of their comfort zone. Only when we challenge ourselves spiritually can we grow and change and flourish. And sometimes a little religious stress, even some cognitive dissonance, makes us stronger, deeper, and wiser. A great lesson from the natural world for each of us on this beautiful morning. By the way, there's nothing better than the sense of true community that exists for me personally at this Oneg Rabbinic Conference, where the rabbis are bright, accomplished, talented, inspirational, interesting, and above all, compassionate and incredibly mutually supportive. It's a great group, and refreshing to spend time sharing learning and collegiality. One more personal note on this morning. I had the privilege last week of presenting the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award to two outstanding individuals who worked to make a difference in the Jewish world last weekend. They were the 2013 winners of a large annual award given by my family's foundation in memory of my grandfather, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan, and my grandmother, A. Irma Kohan, to those who make a major contribution for Jewish unity, education, arts and culture, or rescue. The two winners, you'll hear from them later this winter, were Harriet Rossetto, who started a wonderful program called Beit Tshuva in Los Angeles that rescues Jewish addicts, drug addicts, alcoholics, and others, and Rabbi Kinneret Shiryon, the founding rabbi of a congregation in Modin, Israel, that does magnificent work with developmentally challenged children in Ramla, Israel. Both very deserving winners and wonderful people as well. There's really nothing more energizing than feeling as though you are helping those who are doing God's best work in the world. Maybe that helps make us anti-fragile. Anyway, may these two continue to go from strength to strength. To play us in this morning, here's an upbeat praise to God, Psalm 150, sung by Benji Ellen Schiller, the cantor. Praise God with every instrument in the orchestra and, of course, with voice. That was Hallelujah, the choral and orchestral Psalm 150, sung by Benji Ellen Schiller and the Zamir Chorale of Boston. Our guest this morning is Mitch Albom, the best-selling author of Tuesdays with Maury and a string of bestsellers, including his new The First Phone Call from Heaven. Find out what motivated him to write about how we can hear the voices of those who can no longer speak to us and why that matters when we return on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Mitch Albom seems to have had a variety of successful careers all at the same time. A Jewish kid from New Jersey who graduated from Brandeis, he was a working rock musician and pianist in his youth who became an accomplished and acclaimed sports writer, journalist, radio and TV host, lyricist and composer, and then has achieved worldwide success as an author, beginning with his New York Times number one bestseller, Tuesdays with Maury and Five People You Meet in Heaven, continuing through Emmy-winning TV and stage versions of his book, some of which he wrote the script and screenplays for, including Have a Little Faith. His new book is called The First Phone Call from Heaven. Mitch Albom is also the founder of seven charities, many in the Detroit area, all of which do what we used to call God's work. Good morning and welcome, Mitch.
It's not called God's work anymore.
I call it tzedakah, but, you know, we can be broad about this.
Sure, why not? Thank you for having me on your program.
Delighted to have you. Tell me where the idea came from for the new book.
Sadly, it came from a series of strokes that my mother suffered, which robbed her of the ability to speak about 3 years ago. And my mom was, like many Jewish mothers, she loved verbal communication. And then when suddenly she couldn't speak anymore, I haven't heard her voice now in 3.5 years. And it really struck me how much we miss the sound of our loved ones. And I began to notice how people save answering machine messages of people who die, even though they're very mundane messages, just to hear their voice again. So I got the idea for a book that sort of explored, well, what if you got to hear those voices one more time? And The First Phone Call from Heaven is basically a bit of a thriller story, really, a mystery about what happens when the phones start ringing in this tiny little Michigan town, and it's people calling from heaven, only it only happens to a handful of people, and it only happens in this one town on the whole planet. And how the world reacts to that, and who doubts it, and who comes to be part of it, and how it gets bigger and bigger and bigger is sort of the arc line of the book.
You know, phones have taken on a larger and larger place in our society. I have three teenagers. It's very difficult to get their attention away from their phones. Did that play any part in kind of this premise?
It did, because, you know, what happens in the book is that as the story gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and people start flocking on the town, and they start bringing their phones, and everybody figures it's just some technological thing that they can tap into, and if they get the right phone, or if they buy the same phone as the other people, and then the media gets a hold of it, and it becomes this big story. And meanwhile, there's this one guy who sort of represents the other side, and he's very downtrodden. He was in prison for something he didn't do. His wife died while he was in prison, so he's really brokenhearted, believes in nothing.
Right, that's Sully, the former pilot.
That's right. He's a disgraced pilot, and his son comes home one day, 7-year-old boy with a toy phone, and says, when is mommy going to call us? Hmm. And he becomes so enraged that his son is being filled with false hope that he sets out to prove that the whole thing is a hoax. And he starts, you know, examining and going through, and of course, technology starts to play a part in all of this, because you can examine things now the way the world works with the phone records and computers and all the rest of it. And it did occur to me that we live in a world, as you correctly pointed out, with more phones than ever before, and yet we use them less and less for actual communication. We text, we Instagram, we Facebook, but we don't speak. And I thought, well, that's a terrible thing, because human contact is through the voice. No one ever says, boy, I miss the way my wife used to text me, you know, but they miss conversations. And so part of the kind of bigger picture of the thing is to cherish the human voices while we still have them, and not turn it into something we wish we had back after they're gone.
We will talk much more with Mitch Albom. His new book, very entertaining and interesting, deals well with hope and First Phone Call from Heaven. We will talk in just a few moments when we come back on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on Two Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at 2jewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. And now we welcome a favorite feature, our Zen Judaism moment, the Two Jewish Haikus for Jews. Testing the warm milk on her wrist, she sighs softly, but her son is 40. And a lovely nose ring, excuse me while I put my head in the oven. Yes, that was our Zen Judaism segment, two classic haikus for Jews. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set for June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. If you're interested in going with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to Jerusalem to the Galilee, please email 2jewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's going to be a great trip to Israel. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov. Good morning, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Last week, we began speaking about Ethiopian Klita, the absorption of Ethiopian Jews into Israel, celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. And of course, some have still come. Many, many came about 20 years ago. We talked about the overall issue and then some of the social issues in terms of the change in the family. There was the role of the Kes, who was kind of the leader, cross between a rabbi and a, I don't know, provincial mayor or something. That position has kind of faded in the Ethiopian communities. And you have especially an Ethiopian visitor coming here to our community. Talk a little bit about what the social changes have been within the Ethiopians. And Ms. Ayaso will represent when she comes here, a little bit about that.
Yeah, so actually tomorrow she will get here.
Arrive here
from Seattle, because it's part of our Partnership Together program. So she will visit three Jewish communities. Of course, Tucson is number one.
Of course.
Yeah. And she will actually, she's coming from Kiryat Malachi, but she spent 5 years in New York. But first, she on the age three, she made Aliyah by herself with Operation Moses. So she walked from Gondar to Sudan.
Wow.
So she experienced this
as a small child.
Yeah. Now she's at her 30th. So she will come here and she will spend two full days. Like, she will give five talks a day at least. She will meet a lot of people from the Jewish community, and she will share her personal story, how is to come to Israel with her family. She used to have her father the leader, and then to come to Israel, and then the mother, she is the leader, because the females are usually adjust easily and she finds the job. So she will share her story, and also she will tell about her current position. She works with youth at risk in Kiryat Malachi, and as our audience and you recall, I share that the Federation here fund a lot of program for Ethiopians in Kiryat Malachi. So it will be a very nice to hear from, you know, firsthand how, you know, our community is helping the to absorb the Ethiopians
into Israel.
In Israel, in Kiryat Malachi.
You know, of course, there's a very famous Israeli now, the beauty contest winner, who is Ethiopian, and everybody thinks it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Ethiopians have moved into, there have been Ethiopians in Knesset. There, Ethiopians are beginning to succeed more socially. They've had a harder time than, say, Russians in assimilating into the economy. What does a Partnership 2000 kind of work do to help the Ethiopian community? What are the specific ways in which it works with Ethiopians in Kiryat Malachi and elsewhere?
So the partnership, not in general, they are helping a lot through Ovedet Socialit, a social worker that works with the families and actually help them to adjust to the new structure in Israel. And also there is a lot of program that allow kids, Ethiopian kids, and actually not just Ethiopian kids, but kids to experience arts and through arts to express themselves, music, sports.
Dance, all the different ways of expressing themselves. Mm-hmm. So it gives them an opportunity to connect in new ways with Israeli society. It's great. And if anybody has a chance, if you are here in Tucson listening, this coming Tuesday, there's an open lunch in the Northwest to come meet a representative of the Ethiopian community of Israel. Thanks so much, Ashrat. We'll talk
Thank you
next
very
week.
Much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, J-E-T-C-O, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. The state of Arizona allows its taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get a 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Tax credit's not a deduction. Your taxes are reduced by the amount you give. Join over 750 supporters last year who donated money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. There's an additional tax credit now, the switcher credit, which increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,031 for single filers, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we are fighting every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, we should all take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to help foster a Jewish identity for our community's children. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive the financial aid they need to receive a good Jewish education. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, call 520-647-8442, again 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, last week we were talking about art collected by Jews before the Holocaust, confiscated or forced into being given away or forced sales or any of the ways in which those collections were taken by the Nazis and their allies. And then what happened to the art afterwards, some of which is surfacing now. So many years after the end of World War II, you know, 1945 to 2014, large collections have emerged. And we were talking a little bit about the way
that Jews had collected art before the war showed to some that they were too wealthy, too elite, contributed to anti-Semitism. I wanted to also mention, Jews also seemed to patronize a lot of cutting-edge art in that era. They were more willing to take chances with their newly found wealth since emancipation. And so those collections included Matisse and Klee and Picasso and lots of really fantastic artists. Klimt, right. Some of the most valuable paintings in the world today. And now how do we trace them back? Or, you know, what's the right thing for, let's say, a museum in, I don't know, Prague or somewhere to do with a painting that now they know has a Jewish provenance?
And, of course, Hitler, who liked boring still lifes and pastoral scenes, right, branded most of this art degenerate and cited it as further evidence that Jews were a toxic race and somehow
destroying
poison
culture,
in the body of, right, German culture. But, I mean, I think that's a separate question of Jews recognizing talent or being willing to gamble. I mean, that continues in some of the great American collections post-war as well.
Sure.
That Jewish collectors and buyers help young artists and sculptors to establish reputations and make their names. But the bigger question you touched on when you mentioned, you know, post-emancipation is that the nature of anti-Semitism in Europe really changed from being religiously based to economically based as the 19th century came to a close and the 20th century dawned. It's when the term anti-Semitism was first coined, when there were legally and overtly anti-Semitic political parties in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in Germany, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, one of the reasons is, let's be frank, in countries where, you know, no more than 1 or 2% of the population was Jewish, there were big cities like Vienna, Warsaw, Prague, Budapest, Vienna, et cetera, where in certain elite professions like lawyers, doctors, university professors, newspaper editors, et cetera, anywhere between 30 and 70% of the people in those professions were Jewish. And non-Jews remembered 50 years ago when Jews had been confined to ghettos and they were seen as poor and ignorant and superstitious and thought that there must be some kind of shenanigans going on. I mean, how did these Jews come so far so quickly? And why was it that if you wanted to go to a doctor or a lawyer or whatever in 1890 in Vienna, you had to go to somebody like Sigmund Freud who was Jewish? And this created, I think, a lot of the momentum that seemed to make the unfolding of the Holocaust almost as inevitable as a Greek tragedy.
Fascinating. You know, it's so difficult, I think, for Jews still today, knowing that we don't live in America, we don't live with that specter of anti-Semitism in the same way, but to realize that hard work and education and all of the values that came forward to allow Jews to ascend somehow also triggered this anti-Semitic response, including their art collections.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Hello?
Is this Rabbi Steinberg?
Yes.
This is the IRS.
Yes.
Do you have a congregant named Milton Siegel?
Yes.
Did he donate $1 million to the temple?
He will. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In a mitzvah that's at the heart of Jewish religious experience today, in our portion of Truma this week, God commands the Israelites, Asuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham, make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell among you. With this statement, the book of Exodus moves from practical laws to ritual ones. The plans for the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first site of national worship, the directions for building the Ark of the Covenant, all are explained in detail. In order to create the new central shrine for prayer, the place where God's presence will actually be, Moses calls on the people of Israel to donate materials from the best of what they have, what comes to be called a truma offering. And a remarkable thing happens. When the people are asked to donate gifts to build the holy structures needed to worship God, they come forward immediately and give much more than is required.
Moses actually has to ask the Israelites to stop bringing so much gold and silver and so many precious fabrics. This marks the first and only time in history when a temple building campaign brought in more than was asked for. May it happen again sometime soon. In any case, the word for this experience is truma, a free will offering, a gift to God out of the goodness of our hearts. This generous offering is a powerful thing indeed, for when it is constructed, the tabernacle in the wilderness, built from such free generosity, immediately is filled with God's presence, the Shekhinah. When we give freely of ourselves to our temples today, in time, love, care, or funds, we seek to recreate that free will offering, the full gift of heart and hand of our ancestors in Moses' time. And when we succeed in doing so, we too bring God's presence and love into our lives. The great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai wrote beautifully and sensuously on the subject of the synagogue in his final book, Open, Closed, Open. He wrote, "I studied love in the sanctuary of my childhood. I sang Come, Sabbath Bride on Friday nights with a bridegroom's fever. I practiced longing for the days of the Messiah. I conducted yearning drills for the days of yore that will not return. The cantor serenades his love out of the depths. Kaddish is recited over lovers who stay together. The male bird dresses up in a blaze of color, and we dress the rolled-up Torah scrolls in silken petticoats and gowns of embroidered velvet held up by narrow shoulder straps. And we kiss them as they are passed around the synagogue, stroking them as they pass, as we pass." Yehuda Amichai's poem, "May we find love of God and holiness in the temple sanctuary we choose to enter to." When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, best-selling author, playwright, screenwriter, radio and TV commentator Mitch Albom will explain what makes his book so, well, Jewish. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A positive news story to begin. A recently released study by the World Bank showed that Israel is the second most philanthropic nation in the world by percentage of GNP, trailing only the United States. Last year, Israeli giving to charities rose by a somewhat startling 8.8%, demonstrating a continuation of the trend in Israeli society of a growing commitment to individual philanthropy and a diminishing dependence on the state to provide for those in need. In other news last week, after five rockets were fired from Gaza into Ashkelon, the large Israeli city nearest the Gaza Strip, the Hamas terrorists in charge of Gaza passed a message to Israel through Egypt, claiming the organization was not interested in breaking the status quo of basically a ceasefire. Apparently, all the different Gaza factions in the Strip met last weekend at Hamas's initiative. The participants were clearly told they must show restraint in order to prevent additional Israeli strikes into the Strip. The meeting concluded with the understanding that all factions will maintain the peace from Gaza, though a rocket was fired toward Shar HaNegev just a few hours later. Hamas was furious with those shooters, who were most likely affiliated with Islamic Jihad, and immediately announced they will resolutely operate against anyone who attempts to launch rockets towards Israel. Apparently, At that stage, another message was passed to Israel, claiming again that Hamas was not interested in an escalation and its forces would be deployed to prevent future incidents. Israel responded through Egyptian and UN channels that it was also not interested in a military escalation, though it emphasized the IDF will retaliate for every rocket firing. The Egyptians clarified to Hamas the Gazan government cannot give Israel any excuse to attack, and Hamas must neutralize the factions efficiently. The Egyptians also mentioned that Israel will be obligated to relax its military posture should the rocket firing stop, God willing. The communication between the two sides through the Egyptian mediator was intensive and immediate, which could explain the rivals' desire to return to a lull in hostilities. The diplomatic contacts with Egypt continued daily. Last week, there was mounting concerns about an escalation after an attempted assassination of Islamic Jihad operatives by the Israeli Air Force. The man who was hit was seriously wounded. The IDF said the casualty was the man responsible for the rocket fire on Ashkelon. The concerns of an escalation led to the deployment of an Iron Dome battery protecting Ashdod in Israel. By the way, Ashdod area schools, which are not built to withstand rocket fire, were all closed for half a day, leaving 3,500 kids off of school until noon. In other, unfortunately, terrorist news from Israel, Shin Bet officials announced last week that they arrested three Palestinians, two of them East Jerusalem residents with Israeli ID cards, for involvement in an al-Qaeda plan to carry out terror attacks in Israel. The group had planned two simultaneous suicide attacks, the Shin Bet said, one at the International Convention Center in Jerusalem and the other at the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv. The three men were arrested on, get this, December 25th, but a gag order in the case was only lifted last week. A high-ranking Shin Bet official in Tel Aviv said a member of one of the al-Qaeda-linked global jihad groups operating in Gaza had recruited the three men over the internet. The recruiter identified himself only by the religious nickname Arib al-Sham. The outstanding dude from Syria is probably the best translation, told them that he worked for Ayman al-Zawahiri, who took over the leadership of al-Qaeda after the Americans killed Osama bin Laden in May of 2011. The Shin Bet's announcement demonstrates that jihad groups have not yet prepared themselves for the post-Edward Snowden era, with the large-scale wiretapping and tracking of internet traffic being done by intelligence agencies in the West and indirectly by the Israeli agencies. Nor are they yet taking sufficient care to avoid being caught having open conversations over the internet. Still, al-Qaeda's policies towards Israel have become even more extreme recently. In May 2013, al-Zawahiri himself published a video clip in which he called on Muslims to participate in jihad against Israel and told the terrorist group's operatives on Israel's borders, mainly in Syria and the Sinai, to carry out terror attacks against Israel. According to Shin Bet officials, the recruiters claim that he worked for al-Zawahiri, which is unconfirmed, is based on statements made by the suspects during questioning. And our Better Late Than Never department reports that France, nearly 3,500 years after the wrongful execution of a French Jew, has decided that he should be exonerated. It was a blood libel case in which the man was convicted of blood libel and martyred. The village of Glatigny in the eastern district of the Moselle set the record straight last week on the wrongful conviction of Raphael Levy in 1670 for murder. Levy, a merchant, was found guilty and burned at the stake for the alleged killing of a three-year-old, Didier Lemoyne, for supposed ritual purposes. City officials have affixed a plaque in Levy's memory to a public building in the village of Glatigny, near where he was killed. The text calls him a Jewish martyr from Boulay, Levy's village, who was accused of a ritual crime he did not commit. About 100 people attended the ceremony, including members of the Jewish community of Moselle and Joël Mergui, president of the Consistoire, the French Jewish community's organization responsible for religious services. Today we are back to square one, we are reconciled, we resume normal relations with the Jewish community, said the mayor of Glatigny, Victor Stallone. Glatigny was cursed since that time because of a principled prohibition decided upon by the Jewish community. Stallone referred to a decree issued by leaders of French Jewry following Levy's execution in the year 1670. He said that the Jewish community had declared Glatigny accursed and instructed Jews not to set foot there. No word on what prompted Glatigny to address its 350-year-old sin right now, but I suppose it's about time. And finally, Jewish rap star Drake, whose dad is black and whose mother is Jewish, appeared on Saturday Night Live last week and did a shtick about his bar mitzvah 14 or so years ago. In a fake flashback, Drake's mother supposedly tells him his name shouldn't be Drake, it should be Drake Cup. And then he segues into this version of Hava Nagila.
I'm black and Jewish, don't be so foolish. I'm black and Jewish, it's a mitzvah. Please don't forget I'm black. Please don't forget I'm Jewish. I play ball like LeBron and I know what a W-2 is. Chilling in Boca Raton with my mensch, Lenny Kravitz. The only purple drink we sip is purple Manischewitz. At my show, you won't simply put your hands in the air. We can also raise a chair or recite a Jewish prayer like...
A very different kind of bar mitzvah for the rapper Drake last Saturday night. Silly, but very fun. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's Mitch Albom, who is the New York Times number one best-selling author of Tuesdays with Morrie and Five People You Meet in Heaven. And his really interesting and, I would say, controversial in a funny way, new book, The First Phone Call from Heaven. Mitch, I want to go a kind of a different direction. You've done so many different things, and you were such a successful sports writer for so long for the Detroit Free Press. You're still on the Sports Reporters. You have a radio show. Sports was always sort of the venue for hope and heroism, and in recent decades, it's become something quite different with all the stories about performance-enhancing drugs and arrests and all of the stuff that we hear about all the time, money. Your books are really about hope and faith. How do you reconcile those two?
Well, you know, I don't just move in the world of sports. And
of course,
I think even within the world of sports, and for all the bad things that you've pointed out, there are still those inspirational and heroic moments. They're fewer and far between, and you have to be careful that you're not putting your faith and hope into somebody who's really going to let you down. But I think hope is an essential fabric of life. Without it, I don't see much point in going on. I think that it is a uniquely human characteristic. I don't think that elephants, you know, hope that there's going to be food somewhere. They just go where their instincts tell them. And you know, I don't think deer or squirrels hope that tomorrow they'll get a promotion, but human beings do. And I think it's what enables us to get through the difficulties in life. And I've always embraced it in my books, I guess because the most formative experience I had, both literary and personal, was the Tuesdays with Morrie time that I spent with my old professor, Morrie Schwartz, and he was dying from about the worst disease that you could imagine, Lou Gehrig's disease.
Right, ALS.
It's a very, very difficult way to go out. Not only is it painful, not only does it rob you of every single basic human characteristic that you're familiar with, but your mind stays perfectly intact. So as you need to be carried and wiped and have your tears dried, your mind is just the way it always was. And yet he was hopeful. He was, you know, optimistic about life and about the people, and he found the good in it. And so I've sort of taken the philosophy that if he could be that way, I most certainly can be that way.
In this book, it's not the first time that you've taken someone who seemed disillusioned and helped them find faith. Does it challenge you to do that? Is it fun to do that? Tell me about the process of writing the character.
Well, I think, you know, if everybody in a book about hope or a book about phone calls from heaven, everybody was cheery and they were like munchkins in munchkin land, there wouldn't be much of a story. And I don't think most people would relate to it, because quite honestly, I think everybody who reads The First Phone Call from Heaven, or 90% of the audience, are going to be people who have doubts. They're going to be people who have problems and have thought that hope overrated, faith overrated, the idea of heaven overrated. And so you need a character through which they can identify. And you're correct in pointing out that every one of my books, including the true ones, you know, including the nonfiction ones, have a character that people can relate to who is flawed. In the two nonfiction ones, it's me. And they need to sort of take the ride with that person and see that you can go from thinking one thing, as Sully does in this book, that there's no such thing as heaven, that there's no such thing as hope, that people who think things might get better in life are wasting their time, that life is dark and dank and bad, can have their minds changed, as he slowly does. And I think you need a character like that to take the journey. That's what makes it a story that moves forward, as opposed to just a declaration of all is well.
When you are developing the story, do you work closely with your editor? Are you at a stage now where you kind of write what you want and they say that's great? How does it work?
Conceptually, we talk before I start. I'm thinking about doing a book about this or that. And I'm one of those people that likes to know a good deal of the story before I start it. I don't need to know all the middles and the guts, but I need to know the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
Some authors will tell you that they let their characters take them where the book goes. I've never understood that. I live in Detroit. My characters are union. You know, they're asking the foreman where they're going, and I'm the foreman. So, I tell them ahead of time, and we agree, yes, that would be a good one to do next. Or I've never really been told, no, that's an awful idea. But I have been told, well, maybe this one's better, or maybe we should do this one now. And then I sort of go off and work on it. And I usually have at least a third to a half done before anybody sees it. And, because I don't, it's too early in the process when you're still mixing the ingredients together to have somebody over your shoulder saying, more eggs, more sugar. You want to turn around and say, I'll get to it, just give me a chance. And so it's usually after I've kind of rehashed and redrafted enough times to say, okay, this is the voice of the book that I'm thinking about, and then I start sharing it with my editor.
Mitch, you're involved in seven different charities that you founded, and I'm sure a variety of others, many of them in the Detroit area. The Jewish concept of Tikkun Olam, improving the world, we try to teach that to every kid in every synagogue in America. Did that influence you, or did you kind of come to this by different track?
No, that was a big influence in my life. Both Tikkun Olam and Staka and is it seven or eight? I always forget different levels of charity that you can supposedly achieve.
Maimonides levels of charity, right?
Yeah, and I always remember learning that as a boy, and having that stick with me, that the highest level is that you give a lot and you help a good deal and you give where it hurts and you don't tell anybody. I have not yet achieved that level, because one of the ways that I am able to raise funds for people is using my notoriety, and I struggle with that riddle of how can you do that if it's your notoriety that gets people to help you with your cause. How do you do that anonymously? But I do believe that we're obligated to be part of the community around us. And Maury probably, ironically, he was not very Jewish in his thinking or his practice. He was born Jewish, but he wasn't very religious, and yet he scolded me one time when I was visiting with him about what did I do for my community, and I said, well, I write checks. And he said, well, anybody can write a check. You've been given a voice in the community, and you need to use it for something other than just aggrandizing yourself. You have a unique opportunity to rally people and to bring spotlight to different issues, and you have to do that. And guilt is a very powerful motivator, as you know.
Very Jewish motivator. Right?
And I kind of got guilted into it, and that's really in the mid-90s. That's sort of where I began all my charity work, and it goes on to this day.
You know, it seems to me there's a lot more than guilt involved, because you're doing this in such an energetic and creative way. By the way, it's eight levels of charity, just in case, but it's okay either way. I'm asking a different question. I don't know if it's a Roy Firestone question, but your mom, you know, lost her ability to communicate. What do you think she's proudest of in your work?
Well, when she was alive, I mean, when she was speaking, gosh, what a terrible thing to say.
No, it's okay.
She used to say that what she was proudest of was that I was still the same Mitchie, which is how she refers to me. She's, and by the way, she's the only one, please. But
we will warn our listening audience that it's not okay to call you Mitchie.
Please, don't. No emails, Mitchie. But, you know, and that always made me feel good. I don't think that that's something if you have to try to do it, you've already missed it. But I never saw much reason to change. I live in the same house that I lived in before Tuesdays with Maury was written. I have the same wife. I drive pretty much the same cars. You know, I have the same friends. I never really saw much of a reason to change, although certainly my circumstances changed. But she used to tell me that, and anything that she was proud of was a virtue as far as I was concerned, and so I guess that would be it.
It's a pretty good thing. What's your next project going to be?
I'm actually working on the beginnings of a novel now that it's set in the world of music, and my first love was always music, and I probably know more about music and am better at music than anything having to do with writing. But as is often the case, you can't always make your avocation your vocation, you know. And I tried to make a living at music and failed, and eventually sort of went into writing, and that became the way that I paid my bills, and ultimately became a wonderful way to live and work. But music is really something I know well, and I've never been able to kind of mix the two in terms of writing. I've never really written anything about music, and I finally kind of created a story that meshes the themes and the tone with which my books work, but in the world of music, and it sort of covers the last 50 years of the 20th century of popular music, and it's really fun for me. It's probably as much fun as I've ever had putting a book together, because this is what I do when I'm not writing, you know. So I'm mixing the two things. So maybe you can mix your vocations and your avocations eventually. And I'm going to try to do that with this next book.
So do you ever miss doing music in a cafe, in a taverna on Crete?
Sure. I mean, I often wonder why I ever quit that. It was one of the book ideas that we have with my publisher, which we're waiting for the right anniversary, is that I'm going to go back to that taverna and get my job back for a couple months and just live there if they'll have me, and just recreate what I had when I was 20 years old and was there and didn't know any better. I really was living this idyllic life of I played piano and I sang in the little cafe there. I sang American rock and roll songs for, you know, it was in the tiniest little fishing village off the corner of Crete, and it was in the opposite side of where the airport was, so you had to go 60 miles just to get there. And normally, this is the kind of thing that we work towards, you know. We spend our lives trying to get to a place like that. Here I was there at 20 years old. I was they were paying me in cash. I was playing music and singing every night. I was swimming and enjoying the sun, and it was an unbelievable life. And I couldn't wait to get back to New York. I left it. I walked away from it because I felt I had to get my career going. And next thing I knew, I was living in a hovel in New York, broke, you know, trying to make it as a musician along with 10,000 other people. And only now, you know, when I got older, did I realize, are you kidding? You walked away from that? You know, that's what everybody's sort of aiming for at the end of their lives. So I thought it would be fun to go back and sort of do a book about, you know, what we realize about our childhoods and our youth when it may be too late to do anything about it, and our first jobs, the things that we have, and whether we learn from them, and what if you could go back and scoop ice cream, you know, in that ice cream parlor where you started, or what if you could go back
right.
and just deliver newspapers on your bicycle, you know, I mean, and that was your world. So I may end up doing that one day, but, you know, it involves them. It involves my piano playing improving again, and it involves them being interested in me.
By the way, I my first job was scooping ice cream, so.
There you go. Yeah. I'm sure you enjoyed some of it, right?
I enjoyed the first 3 days, and then I was so sick of ice cream, I never really wanted to see it again. I want to thank Mitch Albom for a great, goes so fast, visit here on Too Jewish. If you haven't had a chance, it's a terrific book, The First Phone Call from Heaven, and it touches on really all of the human heartstrings that we need to be reminded of. Thanks so much, Mitch.
Sure, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And you can also find out more about him. It's MitchAlbom.com.
That's it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Harold Kushner, author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People, speaking on how you know that your life has made a difference. Rabbi Harold Kushner will be speaking here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, on behalf of Temple Emmanuel, Sunday, February 9th. Call 520-327-4501 to get tickets to the brunch to hear him in person. Our playout this morning comes from the 2013 Sharsheret Festival of Jewish Music, 5th annual. It's the prayer Sim Shalom, grant us peace. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sim Shalom.